Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in Wine and Space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss.
Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And today we are moving apace with our Quatermass viewing. We're moving on to the films now, and it's the first film, The Quatermass Experiment by Hammer, from
1955.
You can't escape it!
Maggie, look!
Nothing can destroy it! It's coming for you from space to wipe all living things from the face of the Earth. Beware of the creeping unknown! This woman is about to learn a terrible secret. She will never be the same again. Because this man knows that same secret, he will never speak again. Three men went into outer space. Only one of them came back. Came back a strange, distorted creature, haunted and possessed by something beyond human understanding. What was the terrible secret he could not tell them? Brian Donlevy. He dared an experiment that shocked a nation.
You've destroyed him like you've destroyed everything else you've touched, Kent.
There's no room for personal feelings in science, Judith.
An experiment that created the creeping unknown.
Before we come on to this, we shall get the housekeeping out of the way. We're both gasping, so it's straight out with the tonic screwdriver. What are we drinking tonight?
We are drinking the Lone Wolf gin, a gin from the BrewDog Distilling Company. And there's some impressive info bollocks on this. Gin with bite. Born under a hazy moon, Lone Wolf rose from the ferocity of the Scots forest. Lavender and citrus notes run alongside a forage of feral pine needles, but it's the fierce juniper backbone that stands this gin tall. I think it's a lovely gin.
It's very nice.
It is very flavourful. There's real juniper hit to it as soon as you drink it, which I think is lovely. It's a gin that hits you squarely between the eyes and screams, I am a gin.
It is. It's a good one. I'd happily have it. Five is a one that instantly, I set the first mouthful and that I want the rest of the bottle instantly. Those are my fives. But this is very good stuff. So Lone Wolf, you won't be disappointed with this.
And it's a reasonably priced gin as well.
Excellent.
Which is a good thing. They do another one, which is a citrus, a lemony one. And it's very sharp lemon, almost a gin limoncello. That's really nice.
It's the one that you could drink neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably couldn't drink an awful lot of it neat.
I've had your sister's limoncello.
And your liver survived to tell the tale.
Survived to tell the tale. I'm still here.
I've still got about a litre of it.
Well, to be fair, it did get about 2 pounds of sugar put in it. So it's had its second fermentation.
That's not really how second fermentation works. You do know that.
I do know that, yes.
Okay.
Well, pick up your glass. It's time to descend into the bowels of Podcasting House and open the Black Archive.
So, what would you like from the Black Archive?
Well, we are here underneath Podcasting House, surrounded by all the cans of film in the world that people think don't still exist, and we've got them. So, returning to the public domain tonight, I am going to choose a film. It's called The Mountain Eagle. It's Alfred Hitchcock's second film, and it was a silent film from 1926. It's basically a tangled love story, and it was very poorly received at the time, and Alfred Hitchcock was quite delighted when it went missing because he wasn't particularly proud of it either. But it's number one on the list of the BFI's films to find. They're actively searching for this one. As I say, not particularly well regarded in the annals of history, but because it's one of Hitchcock's, it's increased in stature. And
is it his only missing film?
As far as I'm aware, I'm willing to be corrected on that, but there's not really a lot to say about it. It's a tangled love story about a father, son, and his lover, who all sort of get into a sort of tangled web, where the father falls in love with the son's wife. Yes, it all sounds typically Hitchcock stuff. The son is disabled, so yeah. It sounds fantastic, but the BFI want it, so let's have it back. What's your choice?
My choice is one that exists in black and white, but was originally made in colour. and it's a Nigel Neal play from the late 60s called The Year of the Sex Olympics. Ah. And it's one of his most well-regarded plays because it actually very accurately predicts things like Big Brother and reality television as a method of population control. But when you see it, you'll see why it absolutely screams out to be in colour.
It has been on the list before.
Yes.
Which we just never got around to. These recording sessions are a bit of a movable feast. We start with a reasonably well laid out plan, and then that just goes out of the window within about an hour.
And then get let down by your DVD player.
Yeah.
Because it decides not to play region one.
Not multi-region. Yeah, we've burned out the last one, so we're on a second one. We are now back in the viewing room on the sofa. Spaff is with us, watching. Hello, Spaff.
Is your species the only intelligent life form?
He seems distracted.
He does. Probably because the Quatermass experiment is queued up and ready. Without further ado...
I think he wants some of the gin. Well, tough.
I shall destroy you if you defy me again.
We didn't like that.
You're only several million years old. You're too young to be drinking gin.
From 1955 is the Hammer version of the Quatermass experiment. Ron VT.
I will not have your men coming into my research center and treating Victor Caroon as though he were a pathological criminal.
Nobody
He's a sick
to.
Man, Inspector. He's been through an ordeal that very few men could survive.
Two men didn't survive it, did they, Mr. Quatermass?
What exactly do you mean by that?
You see, Mr. Quatermass, I'm an old-fashioned sort of chap. I don't know much about rockets or traveling in space. I have a routine mind and have to do routine things.
Such as fingerprinting an unconscious man?
When three men take off in a rocket and only one comes back, in our reckoning, that leaves minus two. And minus two puts us in the embarrassing position of having to investigate plus one. Whether he's conscious, unconscious, or a gibbering idiot.
Fine. I think I can save you a lot of time, Inspector, with your so-called investigation. I have here the particulars on all three members of the crew. Medical histories, personal description, academic achievements, professional activities, politics, and even fingerprints.
Well, that's very thoughtful of you.
There's only one investigation likely to serve any good purpose in this situation, Inspector. That's a scientific one. And I'm sure even you will agree that between us, I'm the best qualified for that assignment. Good day, Inspector.
Well...
No, not very. What the hell was that?
There are positives.
There are a lot of positives. Brian Donlevy, not one of them.
No.
That was awful.
He's the only person to play Bernard twice.
We'll come on to this. We've done Quatermass Experiment on our very first podcast. The plot has been well documented. A brief précis rocket mission crashes back in England. Only one of the three pilots is still in the rocket. Investigation after investigation, this one surviving astronaut is very ill. Breaks out, causes a contagion. Turns out that all three of the astronauts emerged into one. Goes on a rampage, morphs into a huge monster in Westminster Abbey. They kill it. The end. We've done Quatermass. The plot's moot now. But that...
We did kind of shoot ourselves in the foot by reminding ourselves of the TV version surviving episodes before watching.
Bad move.
Which meant that we reminded ourselves of Reginald Tate's performance before seeing Brian Donlevy's.
Simon's far more au fait with Nigel Neal, the writer, than I am.
But he didn't write the screenplay.
No, he didn't write the screenplay, and it screams off the screen that the dialogue is riddled with inconsistencies.
Characters are just chopped out. I mean, Fuller Love, the journalist, is a big character in the TV version. It just doesn't appear in this at all. The most disappointing rewrite, to my mind, is Judith Caroon. Because in the TV version, she is... front and centre, part of the science team. Yes, she's the astronaut's wife, but she's also Quatermass's chief assistant. She is there. Technical staff take instruction from her in his absence. She is absolutely...
front and centre.
Front and centre, scientist, respected as such. In this, all of that is taken away. She is a...
wife, as you put it.
Whiny. She's got a dreadful voice.
We should take him to hospital. Will he be better somewhere else? Oh, Bernard, is he going to be okay?
She does sound like Carla from the Captain Kremen.
This wonderful, strong character is reduced to a bimbette.
Yeah. The only thing that does make more sense for her character in this is the kidnapping of her husband from the unit that Quatermass puts her into. And that's because Quatermass himself is such a dick.
An utter twat.
In the way that he isn't in either of the other two. So in either of the other two, she can see that Quatermass is involved and cares what's going on and is obviously trying to get the best for Caroon. So why would you take him away from that environment? With this, Quatermass is a fuckwit. She is prevented from seeing her husband. So she arranges to break him out, and she's aiming to get him to a place where he will get appropriate treatment. Now it goes fairly disastrously wrong and he escapes and goes on a rampage. But she wasn't to know that. So that bit, I think, works better in this. But that only works better in this because Quatermass himself is such a worse character in this than any of the other productions.
From the word go in this film, Quatermass is unlikable.
Yeah.
And it never really breaks out of that.
Nigel Neal, I believe, intensely disliked his performance, described it as waddling through the production. From reading around, I understand Brian Levy was kaleid pretty much the entire time. He had a significant drink problem. Whether that impacted his performance or whether he was just a rotten actor to start with, I've no idea, but this was a very poor performance coming on the heels of Reginald Tate, which was a very good performance.
Yeah.
And this is just before John Robinson, who was also a very good performance.
There hasn't been a bad TV Quatermass. Somebody's got to be the least favourite. It just happens to be John Robinson. For most people, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very firmly in the André Morel is the absolute archetypal Quatermass. Don Levy is the absolute archetypal anti-Quatermass.
There's just nothing to recommend him about his performance.
And the whole egotism. It starts off, you find out that he launched this rocket without any kind of official permission just because he got bored of waiting and he thought it was the right thing to do. And at the end of it, once they've killed off the monster, he utterly blanks everybody who's helped him. And Lomax, the police inspector, has bent over backwards to accommodate Quatermass, and he just completely knocks him aside like it's a piece of shit and stomps out. And the only person he is prepared to talk to is his assistant, and he just says, right, we start again.
The final shot of the film is launching another rocket.
Yeah. So he launched a rocket without permission. It ended up as a disaster. He has no idea whether this is going to happen every time a rocket is launched. And it just blithely turns up another one.
There's so much staggering that's positive about
egotism
this film.
Beyond belief. It looks
amazing.
Fantastic.
They've clearly spent a lot of money on it. Yeah, for the time.
Sets are beautiful. Most of the performances are very good.
Yeah.
For all I have an issue with the rewrite of Judith Caroon, she's actually portrayed very well.
Yeah.
She's not given an awful lot to do other than bimble about on screen.
My husband's so ill. Yeah. What are you doing about it?
But that's not the actress's fault the way it's
No, written. It's not. But
she's not a Paula Quatermass.
Thankfully. They've dropped into American actors into parts which were previously English. The other end of that scale is Paula, where they've turned the English up to 18. The needle doesn't even go that far. I can see the marketing reasons for having an American in the lead role because
they want
to break it in America. But to make that
America
character...
has people who could act. So why did they get one that couldn't? And we're not saying anything that pretty much every other Quatermass fan has said. This has been discussed on other podcasts. Paul Cornell and Liz Miles, Hammer House of Podcast, have discussed this and said very similar things. Birdcast have said pretty similar things. My whole rant about Judith Caroon is actually far more eloquently expressed by Liz Miles in Hammer House of Podcast.
Well, last night, the randomizer threw up the Doctor Who episode Mummy on the Orient Express. And I was eulogising about how Peter Capaldi is my favourite Doctor Who of the new era. Because he's got this quite acerbic, abrasive personality. But underneath it all, he cares, but in a far different way to all the other Doctors.
And doesn't really know how to show it.
And he's just socially awkward. This is abrasive, but just being a twat.
And there's a difference between being abrasive but cooperative and just being as unpleasant and bullheaded as this bloke is.
I was not prepared for this. Whenever we do the Quatermass episodes, I try not to read ahead.
And I know you don't, which is why I deliberately didn't warn you about the Brian Donlevy. I tried to give you a tiny bit of heads up when we did the commentary on the Hammer version of the Abominable Snowman. I tried to give you a little bit of a heads up about that, about the Forrest Tucker role.
Yeah. It was very common at the time. I mean, it's still common that the cross-pollinate British and American actors do.
But I really didn't want to tell you just how awful Brian Donlevy is.
It's both the best and the worst of Quatermass in one film.
Yeah, because it looks fantastic. Oh, it does. Special effects are beautiful. The kidnapper and the chemist, after they've been attacked, the special effects just look fantastic and really gruesome.
Oh, with his eyes gouged out and his hands all gnarled.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fairly unpleasant, actually.
And actually, the creature itself works very well.
It does.
The little mini creature that they've got when it was
feeding it with
slithering
mice.
Across the floor and was sort of rearing up a tentacle towards the camera. That, you could see the wire when you look for it, but it was a really effective shot.
Visually, there's a lot to recommend.
Visually, it's beautiful.
And to be honest, as you just said, pretty much every character in it, well cast, well acted. The script I've got serious problems with. There are just inconsistencies which... I'm not intimately familiar with Nigel Neal, but he's clearly was quite meticulous about his scripts.
Yeah.
This is sloppy in places.
But all of that could be glossed over if they'd had a good, sympathetic lead character.
Wouldn't it have been nice if it was André Morel all the way through the entire canon? Yeah. I would have loved that. I think a lot of other people would as well.
Yes. What ifs are lovely. I don't have a problem with any of the other actors that play it. When we come on to the film version of Quatermass in the Pit...
Wyler's in it from Dalek's Invasion of 2115.
He is. But yeah, when we come on to the film version of Quatermass in the Pit, then that's Andrew Keir, who does a very good performance. Mm. And it's the only one of this original run that's in colour. That one was done quite a bit later. That one was done in the 60s. So there's an order of magnitude in terms of special effects and the whole hive sequence. Mm. And the final realisation of the energy creature just looks amazing. But we've got a couple of films to go before that. Quatermass 2 is... It's Brian Donlevy again. I understand Nigel Neal hated it so much that he bought up the rights to it. And for decades, you weren't able to watch the film of Quatermass 2.
Well, that bodes well, doesn't it?
My first exposure to Quatermass way back when I was a kid was this version of the Quatermass Experiment. I didn't see the two surviving TV episodes until the 50th anniversary, and they did an anniversary big screen screening in Manchester. I went along to that with my boss. But I was always already reasonably familiar with it, having seen the Quatermass Experiment film a few times and seeing the Quatermass in the Pit film. Quatermass 2 was much less familiar because the film wasn't available to see. And then there was a BBC VHS release of the Quatermass in the Pit episodes.
Oh, this is in the early 90s when they were hurled out onto VHS, regardless of quality.
But I wore that tape to death.
Yeah.
The Quatermass output that I probably watched more than anything else is the original TV version of Quatermass in the Pit, because I just absolutely love it.
And having seen the beautifully cleaned up Blu-ray version, staggeringly good restoration.
Yeah, I mean, since we did our episode on that, I think I've watched it 4 or 5 times. Yeah.
There's certain ones that we've done, and they've really resonated. That's one of them.
Outland, I can watch so many times. The Champions, I can watch over and over again. Nightmare Man, I can watch over and over again. I mean, The Nightmare Man is a Doctor Who story by that happens not to have the Doctor in.
Just to give you an insight into our own vanity, we both suffer from the same malaise that we look back over our podcasting output, and we've got a decent back catalogue of episodes now.
We have.
Our favourite one always tends to be the one we've done most recently. There are certain standouts, though. The Quatermass in the Pit one, that was my favourite for a long time.
I didn't think that worked as well as some of the others because it's...
You're overcritical, though. You're critical of yourself.
It was more because... It's more fun to listen back to the things that we slag off, and there was nothing to slag off in the Quatermass in the Pit Blu-ray version. It is an entire episode of us going on, oh, that's good, oh, that's good, oh, that's fantastic. Look how brilliant that is.
It's and episode 14, the Series 11 Doctor Who overview. That required almost no editing at all. That was the pair of us just breathing fire for 45 minutes.
Yeah, and somewhere in between is kind of that sweet spot. Yeah. So a lot of the Doctor Who stuff where we can laugh at the special effects and things like that, but at the same time are clearly loving what we're seeing. Yeah. So Image of the Fendal, Leisure Hive, that sort of thing. We point and laugh, but we point and laugh with love.
With affection, yes.
Whereas the Quatermass in the Pit Blu-ray, it was pure fangasm.
For any fans out there who love Quatermass and haven't bought the Quatermass and the Pit BBC Blu-ray, go out and treat yourself. You won't regret it. This is a late 1950s piece of television, and it could have been filmed today.
It is absolutely phenomenal and an incredible story.
It is.
It's a story that really stands the test of time.
We're very lucky to have what we have on Blu-ray across the board. The amount of archive TV, which really, if you look at it, that really it's got fairly negligible commercial value. I think Network, you've sung their praises about the amount of stuff that they've released.
Network produced some beautiful
that releases. Really is very, very niche and shouldn't even be released at all. And yet they do. And it's cleaned up.
Because they love it as much as we do. The BFI is fantastic for the releases that they do, but they're much more selective in terms of non-fan quality.
Mm.
But the things that they've done, like the Ghost Stories for Christmas, is a beautiful episode.
Is that the M.R. James stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was lovely.
Well, the M.R. James and things like The Signalman.
Mm. Oh, we could wax lyrical about archive television for many, many podcasts. Can you imagine that we do that?
We've done it for dozens of podcasts so far, so not really any need to stop. And we have lots and lots more to go. And much of it is better than Brian Donlevy's performance in this.
That's a good point to stop,
actually. Well, actually, we have something else to add in, don't we? Halfway through, we run out of the last drink and really needed something else to get through the Brian Donlevy. So we have a second tonic screwdriver. And what we've got is Drumshambo Gunpowder Irish Gin. Original botanicals, gunpowder, tea and Irish curiosity. And there's an entire booklet full of the worst info bollocks I think I've ever read.
Look at the state of that.
Yeah. And I'm just going to read the first paragraph because I honestly cannot bring myself to read the whole lot of it. But it says, "The curious journey of a curious mind, it takes an inquisitive questing spirit to produce the most remarkable results. Through the years, P.J. Rigney has taken many journeys from the familiar to the terra incognita." And I just cannot bear to read the rest of it.
Well, the more info bollocks you get, generally speaking, the more disappointing it is. It's like they have to talk it up.
It's like that Australian one that just said, "We put stuff in it."
Yeah, and it was and it was brilliant. This, I am on record frequently as saying I don't like aniseed or licorice.
Mm.
This is aniseed and licorice.
Abrasive and in your face and doesn't do the job particularly well. It's a Brian Donlevy of a gin.
It's not terrible, but
it's not a Brian Donlevy of a gin then. It kind of sums up the
recording session for this.
No, I think that's a little unfair because there is so much good stuff to recommend it. It's all down to the lead actor that's the problem. If they turn that around, because there are some beautiful performances. Thora Heard
does a little
two-minute thing as a wandering drunk. And she is fantastic. Now, Thora Heard tends to fill the screen.
Yeah, she does.
She's just one of those actresses that makes the screen her own. And she really did with this. But Jack Warner, early little appearance for Jane Asher.
Jack Warner literally filmed the screen, as you pointed out.
Yeah, he did slim down a fair bit for
Dixon.
But there's a lot to recommend. It's a fantastic story. It looks brilliant. Just don't judge all Quatermasses by Brian Donlevy.
And there is a good argument here that we've seen a couple of times today for not letting the commercial bods get their hands on the casting director. Oh, what a terrible disappointment.
To round us off this time, we have a review of the Hattie Jake series Misadventure. Only one episode of the series survives, and we did this review a little while ago, but just never got around to releasing it. But as Network have just released it on DVD as part of their ABC Nights In range, we thought we'd add this as a little bonus feature. Enjoy!
Hello, and welcome to the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And tonight we're going to be looking at
the only surviving episode of the Hattie Jake's murder mystery series called Misadventure. This was Hattie Jake's attempt to do a kind of straight drama. I think it ran for three stories, one season, and only the very first episode survives, which is the first episode of the story Strangers in Paradise. She plays an insurance investigator called Stacey Smith, who gets sent to a Greek island and gets caught up in all sorts of dramas there. Unfortunately, it's the first episode of six. I can't really find what the rest of the plot is. There's not an awful lot about it online.
You done your report in the Adams Inquiry?
Same as the last 6 nights. Took his girlfriend to half a dozen clubs, took her home, kissed goodnight on the doorstep.
What's this?
My expenses.
Expenses? This is ridiculous. There was no reason for you to have dinner.
I'd have looked a bit conspicuous with a bag of fish and chips in the Ritz. I'm sick of watching roving husbands. I've sat in so many bars and eaten so many gherkins and nuts and olives. I feel like a walking hors d'oeuvre.
Do you? Then you'll be glad to know I'm taking you off it. Something new has just come in. You're to go to the Tower Insurance Company and find out all you can about a man named Parrish. You'd better get along, it'll be late and have to take a taxi.
When I read Raymond Chandler as a girl, all his detectives took taxis.
We are not detectives. We operate a personal inquiry service for certain clients.
All right. Who do I interview?
Mr. Carver, use your own initiative, as always.
And London Transport, as always.
It's an interesting little bit of television.
We have many, many years ago, you've got to be 10, 12 years ago, you brought this round. We have seen it before. I always find it interesting when typically comedy actors and actresses turn up in straight roles. This is really a straight role. She does play it a little whimsically, but it's essentially a straight role. It works well.
And I believe that was more direction than what she wanted to do. I think she wanted to break away from the whole carry-on thing and play it as a straight drama.
Yeah.
And certainly that's what everybody else in the cast is doing. There's no real comedy from anybody other than Hattie Jakes. And my recollection from, I can't actually remember what I read it in, is that she wanted to do the same, but the director, because she had such a name as a comedic actress, said, oh no, you've got to put more comedy into it. And I believe as the show went on, it became a more straight drama.
Oh,
and so actually, as the episode goes on, it becomes a bit more straight drama.
Yeah.
She starts off very jokey and banter with her boss and all that kind of thing. And then once she gets over to the Greek island and she's overhearing conversations and talking to the bloke that she's gone over there to investigate, the comedy kind of ramps down, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the quality of the episode itself.
Oh, the sets look fantastic.
Well, I was actually meaning sort of a technical, the print that exists. The sound is reasonably ropey. There's only 50% of the sound. One of the channels is completely missing. So it's a bit in and out, and it's unfair to judge it on that. It's a shame, really. But I thought there were some lovely touches on the sets, because there's a breeze blowing through their hair. The blinds are moving in the background, and the plants are moving, the trees. And it's clearly studio-based, but they've made a real effort to put in the little touches that you'd get in a town like that.
Yeah, and the major set for it is around the hotel where she's in. And it's multi-level, and there's a bit of the street outside, and you come along the street and you can see the outside of the hotel with upstairs windows. And there's one point where she's standing at a balcony overhearing a conversation that's happening down at a little table in the courtyard. And then you go up a couple of steps and into the hotel itself, and it looks as though it's all one set all the way through. And then there are stairs going up to another level.
Mm. Oh, they've put the effort in.
No, so some of the other sets are a little flat. So there's a fairly basic office in London, which has a sort of little outside work area, and then her boss's office. And that's quite a tiny little set. The set where she goes to visit the client that she's come over to see in his opulent mansion, that's not actually a massive set. It's decent size and it looks nice, but they've obviously really taken the time and effort with that hotel set. There's a bit where she's on the boat that is...
Oh, yes, there is. Yeah.
Pretty much just her and one other character up against a railing with a fairly flat backdrop, and that looks a little cheap.
Is it a boat? Or I thought it was some sort of jetty up here. Is it supposed to be on a boat there?
I thought that was the ferry boat that was getting her over to the island.
Right. Well, either way, it was a little cheap.
Yeah, but budgets are finite. If you're going to have...
And this was, what, mid-60s, 65, 66?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah.
So would have been about the time she was having all her marital problems with John Lasher.
Yeah. He must have had the patience of a saint, and he must have been dying inside. The personal life. Because there was a biopic a few years ago.
Yes, which was very good.
The BBC went through a period where they made They did one on...
They did Kenneth Williams, they did Fanny Craddock, they did
Steptoe's son, they did Wilfred Bramble and Harry Corbett as the Curse of Steptoe.
That one I never actually saw, although I'd heard it was very good. The Kenneth Williams one is interesting, it's not particularly fun. The Kenny Everett one is great.
Seeing the Kenny Everett one, yes, he'd play out a scenario in his head and then it'd show you what actually happened and it was just a complete car crash. There was a bit with... I seem to remember he popped a champagne cork and impressed all the people around him, and what actually happened was he'd made a complete hash of it. And then there was another bit in a studio where he'd played it out. He was going to profess his feelings for this engineer and it would be very romantic and, in actual fact, kicking the bollocks time, yes. But they did one on Tommy Cooper as well. It's sometimes a bit of a mistake to look into these people's private lives because they are only human beings and performers. And just like every human being and every relationship, there are problems that people don't see on the outside, and really it's none of their business and they shouldn't see. It's just this fascination we've got with these massive performers. What are they like? We want to know more about them. But Hattie Jakes and John LeMessurier and... Was it Tony Hancock? Am I making that up?
Hattie Jakes and John LeMessurier were married, and then she started knocking about with somebody who's a used car salesman or something.
Yeah. But they were living in the marital home, and yes, he moved into the spare bedroom.
That was John LeMessurier.
He must have, his heart must have been in tatters, and he never slagged her off.
No. And were there kiddies?
I think so.
I think there were, because I think he stayed for their sake, to give them a degree of continuity.
Yeah.
I think. It's a long time since I've seen it.
See, we've gone a little way from Misadventure there, but the last note that I've got is actually the end of the episode, which was a bit cringeworthy. Because it finished on a freeze frame.
Except it wasn't quite a freeze frame. It's a Katerina freeze frame.
Or a police squad freeze frame where it just goes on way too long.
Yeah. So she finds a dead body and she's just there, hand to her mouth, looking around.
And the fade to black goes on about 20 seconds.
Yeah, for ages and ages and ages. And it really just reminds me of...
Facing neutral.
The Katerina facing neutral thing at the very end of Day of Armageddon, where there's Nicholas Courtney doing his best, flicking switches, dramatic acting, and Katerina just looking up as though she's posing for stock photos.
Yeah, that. But again, of its time, that's certainly not the only...
I mean, the difference between that is that Katerina spent most of the episode looking as though she's posing for stock photos, whereas Hattie Jakes was quite engaged and proactive within it and actually did some acting.
Because you've just listened to the new Katerina audio, haven't you? Which we'll cover in...
It's a massive crowbar to get the character in. The character is well played. The story isn't particularly good. I wouldn't go out of my way to listen to it, frankly.
We are missing something so far, but should we get the tonic screwdriver out?
Absolutely.
What have we got for tonight? Well, we are drinking tonight the Lakes Elderflower Gin.
And you don't need to be told that it's got elderflower in it. No, it really does smack you around.
Very nice.
Now, I like elderflower an awful lot, and this doesn't disappoint. It's got some quite nice sort of barky bitterness underneath, but the real thing that hits you right between the eyes is the elderflower, and it's lovely.
It's very floral. I'm very fond of elderflower. I quite like just elderflower cordial. This is a good gin. It's not quite nudged into my 5 bracket.
No, it's a 4 for me.
Yeah, my 5 bracket has to be, wow, I'm going to neck this and have another one immediately. It's so good. This is just extremely good. So... Yeah, 4 from me, 4 from you.
Yeah.
Well, bring your glass. Let us descend into the bowels of Podcasting House. We're going to open the Black Archive. So, what are you pulling off the shelf to return to the general public?
Hattie Jakes did a few editions of Jack and Ori. And I remember watching Jack and Ori as a kid and thoroughly enjoying it. And it would just be very nice to have that back. So, I would like Jack and Ori, please.
Well, mine is, it's not the first time I've done it, but mine is actually a radio programme. It's Desert Island Discs with John Pertwee. Now, I think John Pertwee actually did a couple. There's not many people that have done two.
Really? Because it's been going for about a million years.
Early 50s, I think.
Late 40s.
Was it late 40s? Yeah, late 40s it was. And none of those earliest ones survive. There's a few from the 50s, but the very earliest ones. And to be honest, looking back, you wouldn't know who they are. The list exists of the guests on the show.
Good grief.
But I've gone through it at some point, and those really early ones, even I don't recognise who most of them are.
Over 3,000 episodes, first broadcast on the BBC Forces programme in January 1942.
Because I listen to Desert Island Discs quite regularly, because it's a very conversational style, and it's lost now. Interview programmes of that nature, certainly on television, don't exist. And I think, really, Graham Norton's the nearest too. It's a very chatty, informal style, and he gives his guests room to breathe. It's not the Jonathan Ross style, where it's the Jonathan Ross show.
Magic of Wikipedia tells me that their first castaway was Vic Oliver. No idea who that is. In the early 1970s, Roy Plumley attempted to interview Alistair MacLean, but ended up speaking to somebody else with the same name, and the programme was never broadcast.
Oh, I didn't know that. Roy Plumley presented it for 40 years. But the earlier editions were all scripted, and the conversational style that developed, certainly when Michael Parkinson took over in the mid-80s, it became more conversational.
Yeah.
And it was better for it.
The earliest existing episode was from 1951 and features Margaret Lockwood. Just says that an awful lot of the episodes were wiped. Other than that 1951 thing, doesn't tell you which episodes survive. But that's nearly 10 years of the programme.
Mm.
There isn't any surviving episodes. So that's an interesting one. So there you go. Giant watch with 3,000 radio programmes. That'll be a bit of listening for you.
So with that, I think we've said what we need to say. We've done our usual going around the houses segueing bit, got wildly off topic.
And it's a fun little piece of television, well worth checking out if you ever get the opportunity to see it. It's interesting to see Hattie Jakes doing something that isn't as overtly comedic as her normal stuff.
Comedy actors, a lot of them do straight very well. Bradley Walsh, I mean, he's always been the game show host. You put him in a straight role, he's done some really good stuff. Warren Mitchell, most people know him as Alf Garnett. You see him in any of his other straight roles, he's really good.
Well,
infinitely better.
We saw him in Kevin a QC, didn't we? And he was really good in that. And you talk about a thing called Secrets.
We must do Secrets. It's actually on the Ripping Yarns DVD. It's a one-off play by Michael Palin and Terry Jones, set in a sweet factory where one of the workers falls into a chocolate machine and ends up in the chocolate bars. I won't spoil it because we'll do that in another episode. It's just the most bizarre thing, and Warren Mitchell plays the factory owner. So we'll do that another time.
Okay.
But for the moment, we shall sign off. We'll see you soon.
Bye now.
The Exton-Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.